The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
Now, before I introduce our next guest, just a warning that aspects of her story may be difficult and distressing for some to hear. I'm joined now by Aoife Farrelly, and Aoife's name you may be familiar with because this week she waived her anonymity following the jailing of her brother for rape and sexual assault against her, which happened when she was 6, 7 and 8 years of age. Aoife, thank you very much for joining us. The first thing that I want to ask is why you made that decision to waive your anonymity and essentially make yourself known to the wider public.
I think it is very important for survivors to waive a right to anonymity and to call out our abusers. You know, it's very difficult to go through, and the fact that I had to stay silent for so long, it really made a difference. You know, having that choice whether I wanted to or not, it really made a difference to me. And I can't but urge anybody that may be in my position or has been in my position to do so as well.
Well, it's undoubtedly a brave decision, but it doesn't make it, I can imagine, any easier to talk about, because it must be an extraordinarily difficult thing to relive. I'm sorry in that context to have to ask it, but can you tell us what happened to you?
Absolutely. It is extremely difficult. You know, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy at all. But, you know, it began when I was 6, and unfortunately it continued on a daily to a weekly basis for the guts of 2, 2.5 years. It was awful to have to live through. You know, I was 6. I was a very, very young child. At the time, I was very happy, very independent, you know, very sure of myself. And Cian absolutely stripped everything from me. He genuinely just stripped me back to nothing. But I'm just so glad now that, you know, I have the strength I wish I had when I was 8 years old. It was absolutely horrific. It was vile. It was disgusting what he did to me, and what he made me believe that it was normal and that it was okay for him to do what he was doing. And, you know, even when he admitted to it, and even when he spoke to me in court, when he addressed me in the letter that he wrote, he knew what he was doing. And that is, it's absolutely, it's sick and twisted, and he's a sick and twisted person, and I'm just so glad that he's finally getting what he deserves.
And from when you were in that age bracket, from 6 to 8, he was 15 through 17, is that right?
Yes, so he's 8 years older than me.
And how did he try to make you believe it was normal or all right?
It was always like he was reassuring me in a way that I was a good girl for keeping our secret, and that every few minutes, every few seconds, he would constantly tell me that I was a good girl. You know, he'd pat me on the head, or he'd rub my shoulders, or he'd give me hugs and kisses, and he'd tell me he loved me and that I was such a good girl. And it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific.
This was, according to the evidence, a litany of both sexual assaults and rapes across that 2 year period, as you say, on a weekly and daily basis. What's it like to live in the family home with the person who is doing that to you?
It was exhausting. I can't lie. It was absolutely exhausting. You know, everybody thought that we were friends and that we got on very well, and that you could never tell that anything had happened, because, you know, life went on as normal after, and even during the abuse, life just went on as normal. He was able to switch personalities so easily. He manipulated every situation. He manipulated everybody, and he made everybody believe that he was this brilliant person and this brilliant brother, and it just wasn't the case. You know, I even said it, that the mere sound of his door opening or the creak of his floorboard just put the fear of God into me. It absolutely made me sick to my stomach. It was absolutely so traumatizing and re-triggering. Even when I was a teenager, you know, I used to have to sleep fully clothed and facing the door in case he came in, or even if he passed by, it would absolutely just send me into a spiral. And it was exhausting having to live with him for 14 years. But I'm just so glad I got out of that situation. I moved out in August of 2020, and I haven't spoken to him since probably March of 2020, since before I spoke out about this first.
And the first time that you raised it with somebody was with your parents. What happened in that?
So I confronted my parents, specifically my mother, one evening and told her as best I could, as best 8-year-old me could, what had happened. And we spoke about it, and she spoke to my father, and the two of them confronted Cian. And straight off, he had kind of admitted to it, but also said, "That's it, I'm going to kill myself," and ran out of the house. And like the coward he is, you know, he made it all about him again, and again he manipulated the situation. And unfortunately, you know, it was never really spoken about again, and it was kind of just swept under the rug. You know, that was the week before my Holy Communion, and the week after made my Holy Communion, and he was just allowed to slot right back into my life. But, you know, people are speaking about my parents an awful lot, and I have mentioned my parents an awful lot, and I even mentioned them in my victim impact statement, that I don't blame them. You know, they never laid a finger on me. They always made sure that we were looked after and we were well provided for. And I think, you know, he is the one to blame in this situation. And I mean it when I say it, that I don't blame them. You know, I don't hold a grudge for things that happened anymore. I did for so long. I resented them and the house and that place for so long. But, you know, I'm trying to heal, and with that is not holding the grudge over my parents. You know, they're not at fault. They really did the best that they could.
And when they intervened, Aoife, did the assaults and the rapes stop at that point?
It did, straight off, yes. My mother was working at the time, and she ended up leaving her job so that I wouldn't be alone with him. And, you know, they even put things in place that if one of them wasn't in the house, or if both of them weren't in the house, then I would go down the farm with my dad and help him with jobs, or I would go up to my grandparents' house and spend time with them while either of my parents were out of the house. And they always made sure that I wasn't with him ever again.
But were you expected to, I don't mean by them, but by the family dynamic, was the idea that you would put this behind you and be a, quote, normal family?
I don't really know. You know, it's hard to know. When I was in inpatient therapy during the summer of last year, one of my therapists actually said it to me. It was, you know, you have to kind of think of this whole situation as a game of tennis. So once I hit the ball to their side of the court, I can't control how other people are going to react and how other people are going to deal with the situation. And it's kind of stuck with me, you know, that it really is true that life is basically a tennis match, and this whole situation is a tennis match, that I can only control what happens to me and what I do with it and how I deal with it. I can't really control anybody else.
But there's a compounding horror to that. I mean, the abuse itself is horrendous, unspeakable. But to then have to live in a situation where you are sharing a house with your abuser, where effectively you're being protected from them in a cobbled together series of interventions, that's no way for somebody to go through their childhood and adolescence.
No, it definitely wasn't. But I think dealing with it by myself has made me stronger. And had I not been thrown into that situation, you know, I may never have came out the person that I am today and have found so much strength in myself and so much power now and so much control that I have, that even now, looking back on the situation, I am able to go, you know, we did the best we could and we dealt with it how we could at the time. And even when he was confronted, he made limited admissions. So given details that they got. You know, my parents did the best that they could. So.
And what then made you say, no, this isn't enough, I'm going to go to the guards?
I always knew that it was in the back of my mind, and having to live with him and live in fear of him for so long, I just got to a point where I was just so exhausted that I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, it was either speak about it or suicide, basically. I was in a relationship for a number of months, 2019, 2020, and I had broken up with my ex-partner in the March and had started with a psychotherapist. And it was the assessment phase that she says to me, if we have any child protection issues, to speak up about them, and, you know, she will have to report them on my behalf. And that's kind of when it was the turning point for me, was, okay, so you need to get a grip on your life, you need to get control back, and I think it's time that you speak about this. And that was it then. It just kind of set everything in motion straight after that. Then Fidel Mamadon, who has stuck with me this whole time, she then got in contact with me. And then in the October when I had moved out, then that was when I eventually reported it.
And you obviously then saw the sentence being handed down, and the Justice Paul McDermott saying that had it been that if your brother had been an adult offender, it would have been a headline sentence of 10 to 15 years, but that given that he was younger at the time, it couldn't be that significant. Did seeing the sentence be handed down, did seeing the conviction, did hearing your brother take whatever level of ownership he took, did that make a difference?
I even said it outside of the CCJ on Tuesday that absolutely no sentence would be long enough. But just knowing that he is going to pay for what he did, eventually pay for what he did, and even though it, you know, it is a very, very short sentence, you know, 3 years isn't a long time considering I've lived with this for 14, but everybody's going to know his face. And that's the beauty of waiving my right to anonymity, is that everybody will know me, and everybody who knows me knows him, and everybody will see his face. He won't ever be able to live a normal life ever again. He may never get a job. And just knowing that he is finally getting his comeuppance is justice enough for me.
You talked about your experience of therapy. You talked about your experience of reflecting on what happened to you. Where you are now, how has it left you?
I'm thankfully in a very much better place than I was. You know, obviously I will always carry this with me, but those 4.5 months in inpatient treatment has really opened my eyes to my strength and my courage. And even in my victim impact statement, I said that I was in court by my own strength and my own bravery and my own courage. And I really do believe that, you know, it has really, really helped. You know, I always said, at the time when I was in inpatient treatment, I didn't feel as if I was getting anywhere. You know, I was there in 24-hour care and went through an addiction program, and luckily have stayed sober for the most part. But I always thought that it was a waste of time. But looking back at it now, you know, I do have tools for coping with things and managing things, and even just getting the sentencing on Tuesday and seeing him be put away is already starting to the healing process for me.
Well, we hope that this week can be the start of the rest of your life. Aoife Farrelly, thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And just to let you know, if you've been affected by anything you've heard there during that conversation with Aoife, you can contact the Rape Crisis Centre on 1-800-77-8888, or you can contact the Samaritans on 116-123.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.